The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, Sea Realm Vault subscribers, KMO here, and I'm going to start things off just by reading some feedback from some listeners. First, something from Kay. This came in via email. Kay writes, I really enjoyed this podcast as I am a Dune fan, live in Salt Lake, but have never heard of David Hall and his New Vistas Foundation. Douglas Rushkoff's article was kind of surreal, but fascinating. So clearly Kay here is talking about Sea Realm Vault episode number 302, which is not the most recent episode, but the one before that. So to refresh your memory, in that episode of The Vault, I first related some information about a Utah billionaire named David Hall, who made his money basically in the fossil fuel sector and is now looking to spend it all by creating sustainable habitats for humanity. He is a Mormon, and he takes inspiration from a document that was actually created by the Mormon founder, Joseph Smith, and a couple of other people who were contemporaries of Smith, called the Plat of the City of Zion. And basically, it prescribes a living arrangement in which buildings form in rectangles around agricultural areas. And inside, these buildings are meant to be very high-tech, so that they maximize the use of space. You know, you get out of bed in the morning, and your bed lowers down into the floor, and you know, maybe a couch comes up or something. There are videos online where you can see the rooms transforming, and the idea is that you rent a living space in this city, which he calls a New Vista. New Vista is the style of city. Each one would have its own name, of course, but in a New Vista settlement, you rent your living space, but then you have access to all manner of facilities inside this community. So, you know, gyms, pools, coffee shops, office space, concert halls, you know, all this great stuff. He calls it, you know, living in a mansion, but no one person owns the mansion. Everybody living there is paying rent to be able to live there and to have access to all of the facilities in this settlement. The settlement, which is supposedly every square inch that sunlight falls on is either generating electricity from, you know, PV solar or is generating food, because it is an agriculturally intensive settlement. In that same episode, I also read an essay about how Dune is the only online fandom that is worthy of your participation. Everything else is controlled by big corporations. And so it doesn't matter if your thing is Star Wars or Middle Earth or the Marvel superheroes or DC superheroes. Basically, anything that is owned and controlled by corporations, well, when you write your fan fiction or you make your fan art or you engage in discussions about the minutiae of your property of choice, really you're giving free advertising and free credibility to disgusting corporate behemoths which get up to all kinds of chicanery and things that you probably wouldn't want to put your name on. The one exception is Dune, although that might change if the most recent incarnation, or it's not recent, it's still in the future, if the next incarnation of Dune, the feature film that will be directed by Denis Villeneuve, the director of Blade Runner 2049 and Arrival, if that takes off and makes some money, well, then the last bastion of respectable online fandom will be corrupted. But I rather suspect that the movie will fail in a spectacular fashion. I think it will be big. I think it will be beautiful. I think it will be esoteric and lush. And I think it will probably lose money. And it won't. They were going to make two films based on the first book, which I think is a good idea. But I doubt the second one's going to get made unless they shoot them back to back. So back to Kay's email. Kay continues, you said that the resistance to this project was also up in Provo. I guess that isn't surprising, as people in Provo believe they are already in the promised land, and something even more promising isn't needed. Also, it might bring in non-believers. And yeah, that's something that David Hall makes very explicit in the promotional materials that you can find on the website for his project, is that this is not a project for Mormons. This is a project to basically help humans live on the Earth in a sustainable and ecologically responsible fashion. And then, you know, for that project to be a success, it can't be limited to Mormons. So it's got to be open to people of all faiths and no faith. And the Mormon Church is, you know, quite clear. This is not a Mormon project. This is a project by a rich guy who just happens to be a Mormon. Kay continues, I really hope Paul can bring it off, as it sounds like a lovely experiment. But these kinds of communities have been tried before and haven't fared too well. We sort of have one here in Salt Lake Valley already, a manufactured community called Daybreak, a very managed development by Kennecott Corporation on land in the southwest quadrant of the valley. You definitely have to have money to live there, and the houses all look like Disneyland renditions of the perfect suburban house. Keep it coming. I'm very glad I subscribe. So I went and I looked at the Daybreak community online, and yeah, that's definitely not the sort of thing David Hall is working on. Definitely not a communitarian sort of arrangement. Definitely a collection of very nice-looking private fiefdoms, private castles, arranged in a suburban grid. Another email from a listener. This one came in just this morning, or I guess last night, 15 hours ago. And it comments on the episode before the one that Kay was commenting on. This is episode number 301. That's the one in which I read the article about Hunter S. Thompson being such a great political prognosticator and how he identified in the Hell's Angels something that would really find full expression in the Trump voter, which is the ethic of total retaliation. Now, he starts off talking about moving from subscribing to The Vault via C-Realm to Patreon. And normally I would leave this out of something that I'm reading online, but I have something to say about it. So I'm going to read Lorenzo's entire email. This is not Lorenzo Haggerty of the Psychedelic Salon, but a different Lorenzo, who has been listening to the C-Realm and C-Realm Vault podcast for many years. Lorenzo writes, Dear KMO, just in case it's not obvious, wanted to let you know I've signed up for C-Realm on Patreon and canceled my recurring subscription through PayPal. I realize there's a couple months left on my PayPal subscription, but it's fine with me if you want to keep any duplicate payments for these months. Recently listened to your number 301 on the McWilliams article, Hunter Thompson, Hell's Angels, and Trump. Really excellent discussion, and I've since shared the McWilliams article with a large group of my thinking friends, grateful to have many. Thank you for that. On the same theme, I recommend Rule 6 of Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. Set your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. In that chapter, he talks about the Columbine High School killers and the nihilistic resentment mindset. He opens the chapter with quotes from the diary of one of the Columbine gunmen. Quote, The human race isn't worth fighting for, only worth killing. Give the earth back to the animals. They deserve it infinitely more than we do. Nothing means anything anymore. If you recall your history, the Nazis came up with a final solution to the Jewish problem. Kill them all. Well, in case you haven't figured it out, I'm saying kill mankind. No one should survive. Close quote. The chapter ends with Peterson's alternative, Rule 6, which he motivates in some detail. I started looking into Peterson after several mentions of him in your earlier podcasts. Read quite a bit of his first book, Maps of Meaning, and the entirety of 12 Rules. Having delved quite a bit into Jung, mythology, neuropsychology, and evolution myself as a curious non-professional, I thought Maps of Meaning a substantial work. I respect his integration of different frames and kinds of evidence into a coherent and useful understanding of humanity's place in the universe and how to live in it. That book is dense, but it's also accessible to open anywhere and read once you get the frame he presents at the beginning. He set out in the 70s to the 80s to understand how the human species could get to a point where two sides were threatening to annihilate life on Earth over ideologies. The understanding he arrived at then informs the 12 rules, and each of the chapters of that book covers a lot of territory in conveying the meaning of the rule. Worth looking into if you haven't read his work. Cheers, Lorenzo. And Lorenzo signs his email with a Rumi quote, Stop, be still, and listen, because you're drunk. And we're at the edge of the roof. So about moving over to Patreon, a lot of you encountered trouble recently accessing the C-Realm Vault podcast because there was some communication difficulty between C-Realm, Blueberry, and iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use, and you weren't able to log in and listen to the podcast. That problem is going to pop up from time to time because the podcatchers that people like to use, like iTunes or Stitcher Radio or Podcast Fanatic or whatever you like, they're always being updated, they're always changing, and eventually changes that they make at their end are going to break the whole system in terms of me creating content, posting it to the CROM Vault RSS feed, and you getting it via your podcatcher of choice. That's much less likely to happen to people who subscribe via Patreon, because Patreon is a big company, they have teams of engineers whose job it is to keep all of that stuff working. I have a webmaster who is just one person and she administers many sites. So while she works hard to keep the CROM site working and the CROM Vault RSS feed working with iTunes or whatever it is you'd like to use it with, there will be occasional service interruptions. There is no avoiding it. Subscribing to the Vault through CROM is $8 a month. It's $7 on Patreon, but many people who have moved over from CROM have voluntarily paid more. In fact, some have paid more than $8. Let me extend to you this invitation and do so completely sincerely. If you want to move over to Patreon, I realize it's a few minutes of your time. If you don't already have a Patreon account, it is a matter of getting your credit card out of your wallet one more time. It's also a matter of interacting with PayPal to cancel your current renewing payment that you make for the Vault through PayPal. So if you go to the trouble of doing all that, go ahead and take that dollar a month discount. And again, the month that you make the change is basically free because you're paying for a month in advance via CROM.com and PayPal, and you're paying for the month gone by with Patreon. But thank you to everybody who voluntarily, through Patreon, pays $8 a month or more. I really appreciate it. All right, back to episode number 302. This is a comment that Gus left on the CROM website. And if you'll recall, in the same episode where I talked about Dave Hall and his attempts to create the New Vista community here in Vermont and the Vermonters' staunch resistance put up by Vermonters, which basically convinced Dave Hall to set his sights on creating his first community someplace else. In addition to that, I also read the entirety of an essay by Douglas Rushkoff in which he described being paid to give a presentation, and the presentation, it turned out, was not in front of an audience, not a big audience anyway. It was just a few very rich people in a room asking him questions. And they asked him some fairly generic questions at first about where he thought the future was headed. And then they got very specific. And when they revealed their actual motivations for getting him there, what they revealed was kind of creepy. They had all created doomsteads. Luxury apocalypse bunkers, basically some place where they can go when the shit hits the fan, when something they all collectively refer to as the event, they don't know the specifics of the event, but they know that something is going to take down industrial civilization, and they want to be insulated from the pain. So they have built their underground bunkers. Or maybe their strongholds are on islands. I mean, there are a lot of ways to go with that. But the problem is, they know they're going to need security. Right now, they have private security that they pay, and the private security people are loyal to them because the money that they pay them with is useful. But when civilization crashes, that changes. The money is no longer useful. Well, then what do you do? How do you keep your private security force from either putting a bullet in the back of your head or just showing you the door and pushing you out into the chaos of a crashed civilization when the money that you use to pay them is no longer worth anything? They floated ideas to Doug Rushkoff, like locking up the food in a vault that only they know the combination to, or putting disciplined collars on their security people. That last one strikes me as a very bad idea. Actually, trying to basically score a quick billion off of your fellow humans and then turn that money into basically an escape hatch so that you don't share the fate of the rest of humanity is a pretty bad plan from the get-go. And that was basically Doug Rushkoff's response that, you know, instead of spending your money and your time and your efforts trying to insulate yourself from the event, maybe you should be trying to help the rest of us avoid that event to begin with. And the rich guys thought that was naive and cute. But in response to me sharing that essay with you, Gus posted the following. Thanks for mentioning the Rushkoff piece. I managed to miss that. I just looked up a bunch of communities' comment section reactions on it, and I'm pretty shocked almost no one sniffed bullshit and called it out. To my mind, there is a 0% chance that billionaires paid Douglas Rushkoff, a public writer slash columnist with various known viewpoints, to ask him wide-ranging questions that he's not an expert on. While they mused about how to keep their security guards in line with special combination locks on the food and water or disciplinary shock collars. It just has every sign of that happened storytelling. That is the perfect kind of meetup that Rushkoff wishes would happen, that he's likely to be daydreaming about how it might play out. The only person I saw calling bullshit was on the Futurology subreddit, which makes sense, but sad I had to go that far to find someone being skeptical. If this story wasn't pure fiction and there's a grain of truth that got embellished, then I'd bet it was some multimillionaires, not billionaires. And they were already into the doomsday prepper stuff, making their money in other ways without having to know anything about the world, and probably wanting to meet and talk to Rushkoff anyway. This is in line with the dismissive view of the story. I, at least, found someone saying on the neoliberal subreddit. In the end, so I'm not going to follow the link and read anything from that subreddit. So continuing, Gus writes, in the end, the piece still works as a thought experiment, similar to Nader writing fiction about what if some billionaires wanted to save us, and gives fictional structure to Rushkoff to write what he wanted to write in the middle section of the article. I'm just not a fan of making shit up to drive traffic in clickbait fashion. And I responded on crealm.com to Gus. I wrote, I can't provide details, but I know a person in real life who has been paid by groups of very wealthy people who are assuaging their anxiety about being at the top of a shuddering civilizational pyramid by paying various people to advise them on how to get through the coming event. Doug's story was short on details, and I wouldn't be surprised if he changed a few things to further anonymize the players so as not to invoke their wrath. But I know for certain that groups of billionaires are looking for ways to survive catastrophic near-future events with their wealth and power intact, and are conducting sessions like the one Doug described. The major concern that they expressed was how to control their armed guards when money is no longer an effective motivator. Doug did research and write a book called Coercion, Why We Listen to What They Say, and Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commandments for the Digital Age. In the area of manipulating human psychology, Doug Rushkoff isn't just some guy off the street, or even the know-it-all hanging out at the bar or barbershop. To which Gus responded, yeah, I didn't mean that Rushkoff wouldn't know a good deal about what he's talking about. More that his specialty is as a writer, conveying things to the public. He's not the awkward but knowledgeable tech psychology expert in a cubicle that the wealthy can use for information and then bully into a strict non-disclosure agreement, or who would just be thankful that someone cares what they have to say. Nor does he make sense from their perspective as a cottage industry consultant looking to ride the coattails of the wealthy while helping them brainstorm ways to survive collapse with their wealth and power intact. If anything, it seems like Rushkoff could be characterized as someone whose whole philosophy is about spreading information and his ideas as widely as possible, favoring bottom-up solutions on principle. He seems like literally the last person billionaires, of which there are only 500 to 600 in the U.S., would bring in and kick around authoritarian dystopian ideas with in person, who is obviously going to tell everyone about it afterward. Multimillionaires, who were already quasi-doomers, okay, I could possibly buy that. But I really didn't know much about Rushkoff before looking into his stuff after reading this, so I definitely appreciate the extra context, and am willing to accept that my BS detector may be way off in this case. So I have not reached out to Doug Rushkoff to ask him if this was a real event that he was relaying in this story, or if it was more of a thought experiment. What did you think when you heard me read it? I mean, various people who have contacted me have said it was weird or kind of surreal. Did it set off your bullshit detector? All right, now I'm going to tell you about something that kind of irritated me when it happened, but now that it's happened, I'm okay with it. A couple days back, the night before, I had rewatched the movie Star Trek Beyond. That is the most recent of the Kelvin Universe Star Trek movies, the ones starring Chris Pine, Zoe Saldana, Zachary Quinto, that crew. Some people call it the J.J. verse, although this third installment in the film franchise was not directed by J.J. Abrams. I saw it in the theater, and I didn't like it. But now, a year or more later, it's on Amazon Prime Video. It's free. I thought I'd give it another shot. And I knew going into it that it wasn't going to be the sort of thing I wanted it to be, and you know, maybe I could just appreciate it for what it was. And I think I did enjoy it more the second time than I did the first. And I posted something to that effect to a Star Trek group on Facebook that has 100,000 members in it. And if you post any opinion about Star Trek to a big Star Trek group like that, lots of people will agree with you, lots of people will disagree, and some small segment of the people who disagree are going to look for ways to harm you. So within a couple hours of my posting my opinions about Star Trek Beyond and the, to my mind, lamentable transformation of Star Trek from a thinking person's science fiction to a action-adventure explosion franchise, I got a notification from Facebook that my account had been suspended because I was pretending to be someone else, which is against their policies. I have been using this account for more than a decade. They make little videos for me all the time, celebrating special anniversaries for me, mostly anniversaries having to do with Facebook, certain people I've been friends with for, you know, certain amounts of time, or communities I'm involved with, that sort of thing. But on that particular day, they decided that they could no longer tolerate, and nobody decided. I mean, it was somebody reported me and an algorithm took action. And I got a form letter basically saying that I had to provide them with a copy of my driver's license to prove that I am who I say I am. Well, the name on my driver's license is not KMO Ocon, which was my Facebook handle. So I can't really prove that I am KMO. Legally speaking, I'm somebody else. I tried to reason with them at first, and I basically just got the same form letter again and again. And then they even stopped sending that. So if you go and look for me on Facebook, you won't find me. I'm gone. I have been kicked out, and I have stopped trying to get let back in. It's only been a few days, so I can't report any profound effects in my life or consciousness. In fact, the change is so recent that when I open a new tab in my web browser, Google Chrome, you know, it shows me tiles of the websites that I visit most often so that I can select one and get there quickly. And the one in the upper left corner is the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook. The group still exists, but I am no longer a participant there, and I don't know if my old banned Facebook account is still somehow listed as an administrator, but that forum, which has been a pretty good place to go to have, you know, atypical for Facebook discussions, it's still there. You can still participate on it, but you'll not be able to interact with me there. And I have decided that that I'm either going to create a new website that's all mine, that I don't have to pay anybody to maintain. I'm thinking of using Wix to create it and put a forum on there and see who I can attract to that forum and basically devote the time that I used to spend on Facebook to something that I can't get kicked out of. Also, I keep meaning to start a regular blog. It just hasn't happened yet, but what little blogging I do, I post exclusively now to my Patreon account. And I put it behind the $1 paywall. So anybody who's contributing $1 a month or more can read those posts. And anybody who is paying $7 or more, which is enough to get the CROM vault, of course, they have access to everything that I put up on Patreon. So now that Facebook has basically gone to the trouble of forcing me to go through Facebook withdrawal, I'm going to double down on that for them and say, all the effort that I used to put into creating content for Facebook, I'm now going to put into creating content for me and for the people who support my work. So while I was irritated with them at first, thank you, Facebook. I have been doing unpaid content creation for you for more than a decade now, and I think it is high time I stopped. I want to tell you about a podcast that I was the guest on recently. It is called 10 Laws with East Forest. So East Forest is a musician. His name is Trevor. I've met him, I think, maybe just once. It was in New York City. But I have known him online, you know, through the online psychedelic community. Probably, our initial connection was probably the Psychedelic Salon. But I have featured his music on the CROM podcast many times, you know, back when the CROM podcast included a musical break. And he has his own podcast now. And so he invited me to participate. And in fact, the episode before the one that I was on featured a conversation with Lorenzo Haggerty of the Psychedelic Salon. So if you'd like to hear that, and I would recommend that you seek it out, the podcast is called 10 Laws with East Forest. I think if you just Google 10 Laws KMO, which is a shorter thing to type, you will find it. Actually, I think the episode before the one that I was on features a conversation with Alexandre Tenous, who has been a guest on the Sea Realm. He's somebody that I knew when I lived in New York City. Alexandre is a good friend of Dennis McKenna. Another podcast in which I was a guest, and it wasn't recently, I think it was back in 2017, is called Greening the Apocalypse, which is an Australian radio show and podcast, and it has multiple hosts, although the one who contacted me is named Adam Grubb, and I think Adam has been a guest here on the Sea Realm Vault podcast. But I got in touch with Adam because I'm trying to spread the word about the Geb webcomic. So I've recently recorded a podcast conversation with Doug Lane for Zero Squared. It'll be on the next episode. And I wanted to reach out to Adam to see if I could get back on Greening the Apocalypse to talk about the webcomic. And he wrote back to suggest a few other topics we could talk about. One of which is a paper by a group of economists and a podcast where one of the authors of that paper talks about it with the host of a show called Rationally Speaking. So I have listened to the podcast and I have started to read the paper. I haven't read all of it yet. The Rationally Speaking episode is episode number 205. The author of the paper, one of many authors, but the one on the podcast, his name is Michael Webb. And the title of the paper is Are Ideas Getting Harder to Find? Now, again, he is an economist, and he and his co-authors basically looked at a lot of different industries, and they were trying to look for industries where there were clear inputs to research, say the number of researchers, you know, working in a certain field or on a certain project, and the quantifiable output of their research. And what they found across many fronts was evidence that technological civilization and humanity in pursuit of the sciences has basically picked the low-hanging fruit, and it's getting more difficult now to keep up the pace of innovation. So thinking about innovation and its effect on economic growth, there are a number of formulas which he and his co-authors use basically just to prompt our intuition about these things. And one of them is that economic growth is equal to research productivity times the number of researchers. And they say that research productivity, which is, you know, productivity per researcher, is falling. But the only reason we are able to maintain the pace of innovation in things like Moore's Law is that the number of people working on the problem is increasing. So in the case of Moore's Law, you know, while the number of transistors on an integrated circuit doubles every 18 to 24 months, that's one way of describing Moore's Law. Another increasing regularity in terms of Moore's Law is that the number of researchers employed to keep that miniaturization process underway doubles with each cycle. So the host of the Rationally Speaking podcast, which I had never listened to before, and I'm glad to have been made aware of it, noted that the response to this paper is falling broadly into one of two camps. People are saying either, well, of course innovation is slowing down, of course, you know, we pick the low-hanging fruit first, and thereafter things get harder, and vehement rejections of the premise, basically saying, are you crazy? Innovation's slowing down? We're in the most innovative time in history. Innovation is just speeding up. And really, this paper, I mean, it's a 65-page paper. I'm only 6 pages into it. I suspect most of the people responding to it, either for or against, haven't read it in its entirety or even much of it at all. They're basically just responding with tribal allegiances and according to their psychology and the narratives by which they navigate. If you're a singularitarian, if you're a techno-utopian, the idea that innovation is slowing down is just absurd. You know, we are on the cusp of the artificial intelligence explosion. The idea that coming up with new ideas is going to get harder from here on out is just crazy and contrary to every indication that you can see if you look around. Whereas the people who accept the premise and think that, you know, it's not only true, but it's fairly obvious, would point to things like the average age of a inventor filing their first patent is increasing. Why would it be that people filing for their first patents are older and older? One possible explanation for that is that it takes longer and more education and more intensive education to get to the frontier of any technical discipline or any science. And so you have to be in school a lot longer. You have to be in a subordinate position, you know, learning your craft or your science from mentors for much longer now, just to get out to that leading edge where discoveries are made. So that explanation, that the frontiers of science have expanded so far that it takes a long time for somebody just to get up to speed, you know, to get out and work at the frontier, that not sure if that is the optimistic or the pessimistic view of why innovation may be slowing down. There are many varied explanations for this phenomenon, which arise from the nature of human social organizations, and in particular, universities and corporations. So before I get into that, I just want to mention a couple things. If you know about Moore's Law, you need to know about two other laws as well. One of them, it's either known as Moore's Second Law or Rock's Law. So Moore's Law is that the density of transistors on an integrated circuit will double every 18 to 24 months, or that the efficiency of computer chips as measured by their performance in comparison to their price will double every 18 to 24 months. But you should also know about Moore's Second Law, otherwise known as Rock's Law, which is that the cost of a chip fabrication plant will double every 4 years. So there is an ongoing process. You might call it innovation, but to me, it just seems like, iteration or repetition of a design process whereby integrated circuits, which are created through a process of photolithography, where circuit diagrams are etched onto wafers of silicon at ever decreasing scales, you know, that's not a process of innovation, you know, not in the sense of a totally new idea. It's basically just refining an existing process. It's more the continued application of an existing process and an existing, you know, design paradigm. But even so, it does progressively give us smaller, denser, more powerful, cheaper computer chips. But just because the research work gives us a model for creating these ever smaller, more powerful chips, that doesn't mean that the chip fabrication plants needed to build them will actually get built. Innovation, research, further refining the process by which we get small, dense, powerful chips isn't the only limiting factor. The cost of building these plants has something to do with it. And eventually, it seems likely that companies like Intel will decide that, hey, there's not enough economic benefit to be had, you know, in building a chip fabrication plant to make this next generation of chips. Let's wait a cycle. Or two. You know, if you go to buy a PC, not a Macintosh computer, but, you know, a what used to be called an IBM clone, something running Windows or possibly Linux, when you go to shop around for a new computer, you know, one of the things you have to decide upon is what sort of processor do you want in it? The computer that I'm using to create this podcast has got a Core i7 processor in it. Well, the Intel Core processors, the first one, which I think was an i7, was introduced 10 years ago, in 2008. That i7 processor was etched into a silicon wafer at the 32 nanometer scale. The most recent version of that same processor is at the 14 nanometer scale. So they are continuing to get smaller. And I'm certainly no expert on chip design and fabrication. So I say that completely upfront and with no pretense whatsoever to being an expert in this field. But it seems to me that if they are basically just issuing new versions of a chip under the same name, that no revolutionary innovation has taken place in the process of bringing out the 2018 version of the Core i7 chip, then went into the first of two 2015 versions of the Core i7 processor, which was the first of the seven different iterations of the Core i7 processor to be fabricated at the 14 nanometer scale. That was in January of 2015. So just in terms of the calendar, you know, that was over 3 years ago. That was more than one cycle of Moore's Law. But the Core i7 chips that were introduced back in April of this year are also at the 14 nanometer scale. There hasn't been any great innovative leap in the thinking that goes into creating these chips. This is an iterative process. But if you know about Moore's Law, you should know about Rock's Law, that says that chip fabrication plants double in price every 4 years, which implies that the technical ability to make smaller, denser, more powerful chips is not the only thing holding back the creation of those chips. And also, there is Erom's Law. And Erom is just Moore spelled backwards. And this is the observation that the creation of new pharmaceuticals gets more expensive and takes longer over time. In spite of the fact that the technology and the methodology used in the research and development of new drugs has improved, do you remember the Human Genome Project? This was the project designed at mapping the human genome, and that when it was complete, that it would unlock a new era of personalized medicine, drugs that were manufactured specifically for the person to whom they were being prescribed. Drugs tailored to your individual genome. Well, that hasn't come to pass, has it? I don't take any pharmaceutical drugs, but if I took the ones that doctors have tried to prescribe to me in the past, Plavix, Lipitor, it would be the same version of Plavix and Lipitor that everybody else is taking. That promised explosion in innovation and power in medicine that was supposed to come on the heels of the completion of the Human Genome Project never materialized. Even though it was obvious to people at the time that we were on the cusp of a great leap forward in genomic medicine. So I say the optimistic view of why innovation is slowing down might be that the leading edge of science and high tech has advanced so far that it really takes a long time to educate people and then get them up to speed in the scientific workplace to, you know, be in a position to do anything at the leading edge. Why might I say that that's the good news? Well, there are a number of explanations that involve just the nature of human organizations, some of which come under the general heading of the Peter Principle. The Peter Principle, which you have probably heard formulated as, in any hierarchy, each individual will rise to his or her level of incompetence and then stay there, is really just the tip of the iceberg in what the author of the Peter Principle calls, or the authors of the Peter Principle call, the science of hierarchyology. So if you were to read any of their books, you will discover that that basic notion that people will rise to their level of incompetence and then stay there gets fleshed out in great detail. So let me spend a couple minutes on it and flesh it out a bit for you. If you are in an organization and you are doing a competent job, you are eligible for promotion. Eventually, you will be promoted to a position where you are not competent to perform the duties which you have been assigned. But you are not so incompetent that you will be fired. You will just no longer be eligible for promotion based on your job performance. This is what Peter and Hull, the authors of the Peter Principle, call your final placement. And so, as organizations grow, and as they get older, more and more of the people within those organizations reach their position of final placement, at which point they're either doing no more productive work or they're doing very little productive work. And all of the productive work in an organization is being done by people who have not yet reached their final placement, which is to say that's being done by people that have not yet been promoted into a position where they are assigned to do things at which they are incompetent. People who are still rising, people who are still climbing that corporate ladder, who are still eligible for promotion because they are doing a competent job, these are the only people within the organization who are doing anything useful. So in terms of the whole social hierarchy of scientific research, all useful research is being done by people who have not yet reached their final placement. So the only way for an organization to overcome this tendency is to constantly be hiring new people, which is to say, to constantly be growing their ranks so that there are always enough newly added people in the hierarchy to do enough productive work in order to support the hierarchy. Fortunately, human beings are not yet immortal, so nobody stays in their final placement for more than a decade or so, you know, before they reach retirement age. If we were immortal, it might be that almost everybody, you know, 99% of the population have reached final placement, and the 1% who have yet to do so are the only ones providing any sort of innovative or useful research work at all. As I mentioned, one of the authors of this paper, Are Ideas Getting Harder to Find, a British economist by the name of Michael Webb, he was on the Rationally Speaking podcast, episode number 205. Julia Galef, the host of that podcast, or at least the host of that episode of the podcast, speculated that maybe there are whole branches of science in universities that don't produce anything useful, but which soak up a fair amount of the research grant money available. so that the people in these departments are good at writing grants. They are good at securing some portion of the research budget of our society, but they don't actually produce anything. You know, I was listening last night, and I didn't seek it out. It's just that I watched a YouTube video while I was working, and then YouTube started playing some other things based on things I'd listened to in the past. And it played a short lecture or a portion of a lecture by Jordan Peterson in which he claimed, and I don't know that this is the case, so I'm reporting it as something that I heard as claimed by Jordan Peterson, that 80% of papers, academic papers in the humanities, are never cited in any other paper. Which is to say that, for the most part, nobody's building on anybody else's ideas, and that the only reason these papers get published is because university libraries, particularly the libraries in public universities, which are getting some taxpayer support, buy these journals that nobody reads. Another take on the diminishing returns of scientific research as an effect of the dysfunction of university life comes from David Graeber. I've mentioned this before. In fact, I've made many references to a paper or an essay or whatever that he wrote for The Baffler a few years back. It's called "The Flying Cars and the Declining Rate of Profit." And this is a line of thought that I think came out of his debate with Peter Thiel, in which David Graeber described a really productive way of generating innovation is to fund a whole bunch of people and say, do whatever you want, pursue whatever interests you like. Most of them won't come up with anything new, but a few people will. And he says this would be a much better use of public funds or research funds than would the current university system, whereby people are competing for grants. And I'm going to read you a few paragraphs from the middle. Actually, it's the latter half of that essay from The Baffler. David Graeber writes, "As marketing overwhelms university life, it generates documents about fostering imagination and creativity that might just as well have been designed to strangle imagination and creativity in the cradle. There was a time when academia was society's refuge for the eccentric, brilliant, and impractical. No longer. It is now the domain of the professional self-marketers. As a result, in one of the most bizarre fits of social self-destructiveness in history, we seem to have decided we have no place for our eccentric, brilliant, and impractical citizens. Most languish in their mother's basements, at best making the occasional acute intervention on the internet. If all this is true in the social sciences, where research is still carried out with minimal overhead largely by individuals, one can imagine how much worse it is for astrophysicists. And indeed, one astrophysicist, Jonathan Katz, recently warned students pondering a career in the sciences. Even if you do emerge from the usual decade-long period of languishing as someone else's flunky, he says, you can expect your best ideas to be stymied at every point." And now begins a block quote within the quote that I'm already reading. This is from Jonathan Katz. "You will spend your time writing proposals rather than doing research. Worse, because your proposals are judged by your competitors, you cannot follow your curiosity, but must spend your effort and talents on anticipating and deflecting criticism, rather than on solving the important scientific problems. It is proverbial that original ideas are the kiss of death for a proposal, because they have not yet been proved to work." David Graeber continues, "That pretty much answers the question of why we don't have teleportation devices or anti-gravity shoes. Common sense suggests that if you want to maximize scientific creativity, you find some bright people, give them the resources they need to pursue whatever idea comes into their heads, and then leave them alone. Most will turn up nothing, but one or two may well discover something. But if you want to minimize the possibility of unexpected breakthroughs, tell those same people that they will receive no resources at all unless they spend the bulk of their time competing against each other to convince you they know in advance what they are going to discover. In the natural sciences, to the tyranny of managerialism, we can add the privatization of research results. As the British economist David Harvey has reminded us, so-called open source research is not new. Scholarly research has always been open source, in the sense that scholars share materials and results. There is competition, certainly, but it is convivial. This is no longer true of scientists working in the corporate sector, where findings are jealously guarded. But the spread of the corporate ethos within the academy and research institutes themselves has caused even publicly funded scholars to treat their findings as personal property. Academic publishers ensure that findings that are published are increasingly difficult to access, further enclosing the intellectual commons. As a result, convivial open source competition turns into something much more like classic market competition. So there we go. Two among many. There's a lot more to mine from this paper by David Graeber, but those are the two things that I wanted to bring up. One, that to get funding, particularly in the hard sciences, you have to tell your funders that you know what you're going to discover before you discover it. And two, as the corporate ethos creeps into the university research world, science becomes less and less a community project where people are building on other people's results. Then it becomes a secretive sort of environment where, because results aren't shared, effort, money, resources, talent have to be wasted recreating the results of other people's research because they haven't shared it with the wider community. Now, is this second suite of explanations, not that, you know, we've picked the low-hanging fruit, that the frontiers are further away than they've ever been, but dysfunction in research institutions and the scientific and academic community generally, which is a more depressing explanation? I guess the answer to that question comes down to, can social dysfunction be remedied? And if so, how costly would that remedy be? Would it require a political revolution? Would it require the end of capitalism? Would it require the crash of industrial civilization and restarting the whole project a couple of centuries back in terms of the level of progress? So backing up a little bit, I referenced this podcast, Rationally Speaking, in which the host, Julia Galef, is talking with the guest, Michael Webb. And she says that the responses to Webb's paper fall into two categories. People saying, of course we have picked the low-hanging fruit. Of course substantial new discoveries are more hard-won and coming more slowly than ever. And the other group of people who are saying, are you crazy? We are in the period of the most rapid advance of scientific and technological achievement ever. I think that latter attitude can be explained at least partially by the preeminence of the ideas of Ray Kurzweil in Silicon Valley. You know, Ray Kurzweil says that Moore's law is really just one instance of a more universal law, which he calls the law of accelerating returns, which is similar to Terence McKenna's novelty theory. You know, Terence McKenna said that the universe is a novelty-conserving engine, that it builds novelty based on previous accumulations of novelty, and that the process is ever accelerating. I think Kurzweil would want to distance himself from Terence McKenna if somebody pointed out the similarities in their viewpoints. But Kurzweil makes a similar argument, that human culture took the process of biological evolution and the slow accumulation of novelty via the process of evolution by natural selection to a new and much faster process, whereby novelty is not generated by changes in our genes, but by changes in the mental models that we create of the world based on feedback from the world. And now we are moving into a period where the imagination, the visioning, the spinning of new hypotheses, the testing of those hypotheses will be passed from human brains to post-human brains, cybernetic brains, intelligent machines, things that can do what we do mentally much, much faster than we do it. I don't remember his exact title, but the folks at Google have hired Ray Kurzweil basically to be their, you know, professor emeritus, the senior representative of their vision of the universe. And one of the effects of the internet and social media and basically just being able to select your own peer group based on your beliefs and your style of thinking is that it drives extremism, because your views are no longer judged as being extreme by comparison to, you know, the population at large or the mainstream, but by comparison to people within your subculture. So if you are in the portion of our society which is definitely strongly influenced by the thinking of Ray Kurzweil and the people who have come after him, then if you think that if technological advancement will continue at its current pace, that's the doomer perspective for them. But if you don't believe that the innovative process in science and technology is going to accelerate and continue to accelerate, you might as well be predicting the collapse of industrial civilization. To them, if you're not a hyper-optimist, you're a doomer. Now, I have more experience recently anyway with the doomers than I do with the hyper-optimists. And if I say things like information technology, robotics, automation will continue to put pressure on human wages in the future by replacing human workers and making them ever more precarious, I get called a techno-utopian. Because I think there will still be computers doing calculations and using electricity and performing useful work 10, 15, 20 years from now. And my point in saying all this is not to suggest to you that you should adopt any particular belief about the pace of technological innovation, the pace of scientific discovery, or the future of industrial or post-industrial civilization. I'm just inviting you to notice that when you step out of a mainstream discussion and into a specialized discussion, the fact that you are comparing your beliefs and your attitudes to people who hold very, very similar beliefs and attitudes magnifies the differences between you and drives people toward the extremes, which distorts your ability to relate to other people and makes people with mainstream views seem like extremists from your own perspective. Or at least that's what I have to say after having been off Facebook for like 3 or 4 days now. Let's see what I sound like in 6 months. I hope that you will still be here with me in 6 months, and that we will have covered some very useful and entertaining ground together over the course of that 6 months. I will talk to you again soon. Until then, stay well.